Remember what we said last week, that my mission here is just to get you thinking about the process of leadership, but you're not going to benefit in the slightest if you don't do something with this. So, quite honestly, stay home unless you're going to do something with this. So we said that leadership essentially can be boiled down to four memorable words. That every great leader is in the business of doing one of these four things. If you were here last week, maybe you remember one or more of the four. There's only two of you, probably, no, three of you maybe that were here last week. Okay, so the first one is to preserve. So you're in the business of preserving something that's good. We'll get into how you would identify that in a little bit. But so every great leader is about preserving things that are good. Any others? Okay, so removing things that are bad, improving things that are okay but still not great, and finally creating things that now don't exist. So preserve, improve, remove, create. Those are the four things that a leader has to work with. And then we said, again, if you're ever in doubt, does the world need more leaders? Can you point to one area in life where there are things that don't need to be preserved that are good, improved that are okay but not great, removed because they're troublesome, or created because there's new opportunities? And I think we can all agree that there's no such area that exists on planet Earth, so leadership is always necessary. And again, we're somewhat cynical. Honestly, hasn't every one of us been disappointed by leadership? Leadership that is, leadership that we wish was, whatever. And so we become cynical and jaded about leaders and assume that there's just no great or not many great leaders. But I suggested that there might be another cause for that. And that is that in a world with over 7 billion people, and all the problems and all the opportunities that a world with 7 billion people could possibly have, it's not necessarily that there are no good leaders, it's simply that we need more people to become leaders. Think about this. What is the scope of your possible potential leadership? In other words, exactly how many things can you really leave your fingerprints on in a meaningful way? And if you say, well, I can, and some time ago we talked about this in a different context, and it was suggested that the military views this as a good leader might be able to give hands-on leadership to 6 to 8 people, 10 people, something like that. Beyond that, it becomes more and more difficult to have meaningful connection, regular connection with the people you're going to lead. And so great leadership requires small circles in which you're going to lead. Well, if it takes one leader for every, let's say, 10, and according to some military theory, that would be outsized and large. It might actually be closer to 8 or 6. But if it takes solid leadership to lead 10, what's that ratio? It's 1 to 10. As you look all around you in life, it's a 1 to 10 ratio. Well, would you say that we have one great leader for every 10 people? That's doubtful, isn't it? And so you can see why there's the need for more leadership.
And also, too, just in what I've seen going on lately, leaders are trying to take on too many. They're trying to influence too many, so you never really influence any. Focus on these 10. Trust them. Let them delegate for you. They'll bring you information back and you can make a decision. But when you start to micromanage, like you use your fingers on 30 or 40 people, you're not talking to anyone.
And that's, we're going to get into that more specifically today. So before we move further on, I thought I'd introduce these couple of additional words just to tantalize you a little bit, help you to see where you are. So you notice the first thing at the top of your first page, conservative versus steadfast. So when you think of a conservative leader, what do you think of? And yes, this is one time where I'll make this exception. Only today you can introduce something political. What do you think of when you think of a conservative leader?
Tradition.
Yes, tradition.
Traditional values.
Traditional values. What is the word conservative? What's its root word?
Conservative.
Okay, so what does the word conserve mean?
Hold that which we had.
Okay. But we've already talked about or alluded to some things that could be a challenge. If the world is always changing, how do we balance the need for preserving the good? And we'll introduce that word, preserve. How do we introduce the desire to preserve good in the face of constant change and the need to adapt and adjust? And so because conservative tends to have with it a clinging sometimes to tradition, a little while after it should have been let go, I'm going to suggest that we substitute the word steadfast. Now when you think of the word steadfast, what comes to mind? Staying on course, not being easily swayed, but if and when the time for change comes, after it's been carefully evaluated, then it is good to change. It is good to bring change. So, do you know from your own human experience people who have clung to past ways of doing it long past when they should have let go and moved on to something better? You didn't have to personally confess. Yeah, some people do that. Okay, now let's just, to bring a little bit of counterbalance to this, let's look at people who have thrown off everything of the past because they reject it all. The phrase that we usually use with this is they throw the baby out with the bathwater. They're so adamant about change that they simply destroy or remove or dismantle everything that exists because they believe that a lack of good results is indicative of complete system failure, so we're going to throw out the whole system. Do we see any of that in place? Why? Oh, it kind of picks up anyway, but thank you. Carefully political, yes.
The whole thing from Woodrow Wilson on the think tank, in 1917 that came up with this idea that we have the brains and the rest of the country will follow or fit right in. And it's gone on to the Hillary Clinton today.
Okay.
And we rejected it in the old Democratic.
Okay, easy, easy. Easy.
But they, some people think they have superior knowledge. And a certain person like Ronald Reagan showed them that, you know, life in America isn't just one thought pattern or one progressive movement, you know, whatever they call it.
Okay.
But even on that, you know, the scripture says on both sides of that, those who believe that they're wise, those who think, follow me, I'm the smart one, that are humble, they're just like, no, hey, I know what I'm doing. So those who shouldn't be fools. And the fools who say, hey, you know, maybe we should stop and think like this. You're stupid. What are you talking about? Let's go. Okay. A little bit of conservatism and pragmatism. So hey, maybe we should think through this instead of just running forward because somebody threw it out there.
Okay. All right. Now remember, last week I introduced a new idea just for this series, that we would primarily focus on questions rather than declarations. I don't want to rebuke you, but I want to invite you to phrase things as questions to help us to think as opposed to statements that just state. Let's move on with this. Progressive versus enlightened. So we have to introduce this progressive topic. What does the word progressive mean? You've already told me what your view of progressive is. What does the word progressive imply? It does, doesn't it? And that is the downside. Okay, so we've looked at the good side to progressive.
Question. Okay. How many kinds of progress are there? You can make progress.
Do you remember one of the other principles we introduced last week? That things don't stay fixed. And we said there were three reasons why things don't stay fixed. The first is that things naturally just devolve and break down. Right? That's the first evident reason. Right? Your roof does not stay a great roof. It's got a 20-year life expectancy after which it needs some improvement. So things don't stay fixed. What's another one of the reasons why things don't stay fixed? Well, because for every measure you take to lead change in one direction, someone is attempting to undermine that change in the opposite direction. It's why I gave you two homework assignments. The first was to review the questions that we talked about at the beginning. The second was to read the book of Ezra and begin to look for some of the patterns that we introduced last week. Do you remember that one overarching pattern? For every good thing that the people of God attempted to do in Jerusalem, they were met not just with resistance, but with significant opposition. Therefore, nothing got done. For every good step that was taken, it was undermined by a negative step. And so you can get into a cycle where both sides battle each other and nothing gets done. Do we see any of that today? Yeah, of course. All right. So let's introduce another word. And this word is almost as hot buttonish because it begs the question who is and who isn't, but the word is enlightened. All right, because now we have to ask the question, well, am I or is he or do they think they are when they really aren't? But in the best of senses, what does enlightened mean? Oh, okay. Boy, you got right down to the core of it there. Yeah. What would it suggest then? Well, how many of you feel thoroughly enlightened? As if there's nothing else to be enlightened about?
No.
Okay. So, an enlightened course of action forces me to continue to consider. And it will cause me to ask the question, is this course of action actually going to make progress? Progress that's good for everyone. Because as you've already said, you've implied, progress for one becomes regress for another. Now, all great leadership is going to have to thread that needle.
But why is it regress for another? For what reason is it regress for another? You said this is progress.
Okay.
Why is it regress for the other?
Do you remember what we said last week? Another one of the principles was that great ideas in the hands of ineffective leaders will wither and die. On the other hand, bad ideas, even wicked ideas, in the hands of great leaders can thrive and prosper. And then we said, well, surely because truth will win out in the end, and I really believe that, truth always wins out, truth always reveals itself to be true, falsehood always reveals itself to be false, shouldn't we be able to rest on the fact that truth will ultimately win? And I suggested no. Does anybody remember why we suggested that no, you can't rest on that?
Because it's not always.
Well, because there's a generation or two generations or five generations or 10 generations that will experience harm while we're in the process of allowing truth to be revealed. And so I suggested last week that the social upheaval and the social movement that we have seen transform the family landscape over the last 60 or 70 years has inflicted harm on people while we tweak the buttons and push the knobs in this experiment to see if we can re-architect and re-engineer society.
I think this is one of the issues why the conservatives
Thank you.
Have gotten so vocal is because of, I don't care who else, trying to actually completely change the dictionary. This word has meant this since the beginning of...
Rhetoric. Are you speaking of a specific word?
No, I'm saying the language.
Okay.
Like, all words. Any of the high-level topics that you can pick, the other side tries to make that, you know what I mean? If you make any sort of like slightly off-color statement these days, you have college campuses running to safe spaces because you... somehow made this insanely far out thing. You've taken this word and made it so far to the other direction just because you want it to be.
Okay.
Not because that's what it actually means, but because you've chosen to utilize language as a weapon to try to influence people. And when you say the truth, I'm thinking of the truth as when I read Webster's, this is what that means. Now you're looking at it and you say, yeah, but...
Okay. What does that reveal? It reveals exactly what we just said. A bad idea in the hands of a capable leader can gain traction and move forward. A great, compelling, and time-tested idea in the hands of ineffective leaders will wither and die.
Satan said in the garden, did God really say that? She should have known better. She talked to him.
Easy. Easy.
And so you're the serpent. What a great leader.
Well,
he just twisted it up a little bit. Offered it up as an awesome thing. This is going to be great.
Okay, and we said last week that since then humanity has been paying the price to learn the truth. And so we can't just sit and take it for granted that ultimately the truth will reveal itself, the truth will win out, and in the end it'll all be good because generations and generations and generations of people will pay the price. Now, if you're content with that, that's fine. But if you're not content with having this generation or the next generation pay the price while we learn the difference between truth and falsehood, then somebody has to stand in that gap.
And that's why it's so important to tell the truth and not just give your opinion.
Okay.
Wars have come about because of this. I watch, every now and then I watch the History Channel, the rise of the Third Reich, the world. And they show how Hitler came into power with his ideas of actually he was a sexist. He was everything that the liberals call bad today. And people just embraced him wholeheartedly without thinking. And they said, oh yeah, we'll have a master race. And we had to fight that idea because it was wrong. We did die.
And it will use that as an example before we move on. What happened? If we read through history, we see there were opportunities to interrupt and intercept and stop that plan earlier on. But because those who were in leadership in Europe and other countries were a little bit timid to tackle that challenge and hope that the challenge would right or correct itself, it only got worse.
Yeah, not to get us all on that path, but another leader in England, Churchill, kept saying, watch out for this man.
Right.
He is saying there's danger, danger. And they said, oh, come on. They really...
How bad can it be?
Yeah, just pushed him aside until the need for that decay. But yeah, one leader said, watch out. Another leader says, oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's a reason that they call all of that stuff cancer. I have cancer right now. It's in there. It just hasn't exposed itself yet. It's in there. You see, every human being has some form of cancer, right?
Now here's the interesting thing.
One way to heal it.
Here's the interesting thing. We love to talk about examples of this in history. We love to talk about abstract examples of this somewhere else. Here's the question. Remember, coming back to those four leadership words, the four missions of a leader? What's good and needs to be preserved in your own world right now? And that's the collection of questions I ask you to ask of yourself, and it should be different for every one of us. What's good in your world and needs to be preserved at all cost? What's okay but needs to be improved? What's just flat out bad and needs to be removed, remember? And then what needs to be created in order for opportunities to be capitalized on in the future? Now, here's the other thing. If we want to come back to that example from Europe from 60 or 70 years ago, what needed to be improved that didn't get improved the way it should have been improved? Because inevitably, here's what happens. When you squeeze down a people too hard for too long, they revolt. Remember, Hitler was just the mouthpiece that appealed to the people. He gained traction because underneath everything, there were frustrated people who had not been well led, and the previous solutions that were to address Germany's failures from the First World War actually set them up for what became the Second World War.
That's right. And it didn't get fixed. It just didn't get fixed. If they would have gotten fixed, there would have been no numbers.
But do you see how? Okay, so to be conservative in that sense would have meant, no, this is what we asked them to do. This is the reparations that they're expected to pay, and therefore they're just going to have to live with this even if their own people suffer. Now, an enlightened leader would have said, but wait a minute, if we ask too much from the people for too long, what's going to happen? And ultimately, we saw one of the ways that that happened.
It's hard to watch a people suffer for their leadership. But what happens if we just sort of say, okay, you guys, it's like sending the kids in a room saying you're grounded. Whatever you do in the house, but you have to stay in there. This is your area that you have to do. So with that being said, if they would have just said, hey, you know what? You guys deal with him. He's fine with you. You guys deal with him. No, we're not dealing with you. We're not trading with you. We're not doing anything with you until you guys deal with that. You guys deal with it. They're your friends. Why are you hanging out with them? Kind of thing.
Okay.
If that would have been dealt with, failure of nerve.
Well, let me reduce this down to the size of the illustration that you used, which was sending a child to his room. Now, if you say, I don't care, whatever you do in your room, as long as you stay in your room, is okay. Can a child start a fire that burns the whole house down from within inside the room that he's been sent to?
Yes, absolutely.
I hope you don't know that from firsthand experience, but yeah, you can see how that could happen.
Which way is the sanction store, don't they?
Well,
climb in the window.
I didn't even think about that.
Now there might be disciplinary action.
Are there things about your past that you'd like to share with us today? Okay.
But then the sanction, if you don't follow the sanctions going. The disciplinary action.
Okay. Let's keep moving ahead. All right.
Let's keep progressing.
Let's do that in an enlightened way. All right. So I want to look at now five phases of a leadership endeavor. And this is your big thing for today that I want you to weave into and tie to what we've talked about last week. So the first phase is observation. Right now, this is not a superficial or a casual observation. It is really to look at what is going on in a situation that you believe is good. Why is it good? Why has it remained good? In a situation that needs to be improved. What's the need for the improvement? Why do you feel it needs to be improved? Careful observation. And this is different from knee-jerk just response.
What's the cost?
I'm going to tie that then to evaluation, where you take what you've observed and you attempt to understand the causes. And now we're going to introduce a couple of stories. This first one that I'm going to tell you about is one of my favorites that illustrates how ineffective observation and evaluation leads to wrong conclusions. So there is a company that is tasked with working with a major fast food company. The major fast food company wants to sell more milkshakes. Now, this is a real story, all right? So the company attempts to solve its own problem. They send in people to observe people who are buying milkshakes, and they actually record this. They're looking for some sort of trend or some sort of pattern. Is it young people that buy them? Is it old people that buy them? Is it white collar? Is it blue? Who buys milkshakes? Well, the first thing that they discover, and they're surprised by, is that people buy milkshakes in the morning. They don't understand it. They don't ask questions yet. They just make that observation. And then again, milkshake sales seem to fall slack in the middle of the day, and then milkshake sales pick up toward the end of the day. Well, that's unusual. And so finally they ask questions. But they ask questions that don't help them get to the answer. Here's what they ask. What could we improve about our milkshakes so that you'd be inclined to buy more? That seems like a good question. But everybody pretty much answers the same. Your milkshakes are fine. They're great. An outside consultancy is brought in to do the same process. But they ask a different question. They look at all the data. They look at, well, there doesn't seem to be anything here that we can derive meaningful results from. So they go back and ask the people one more question. Why are you buying a milkshake? And here's what they discovered. That countless people in the morning would buy a milkshake in parts of the country where they had a long commute and they wanted something neat to consume that would last a long time. And so these were, in essence, this is the distilled down answer that they got. A thick milkshake pulled through a thin straw takes 20 to 30 minutes to consume, and by that time I'm well on my way to work. I haven't got any crumbs on myself from eating some sort of breakfast food that would be gone in a few minutes anyway. And it's kind of amusing to drink the milkshake while I sit stuck in traffic. Well, that's interesting. But then they said, but why do milkshake sales then again spike in the afternoon? And so again, they went back and they started to ask the question, why are you here buying a milkshake? And they noticed that there was this other difference, that the milkshakes were usually for kids. People think, oh, it's kids that want milkshakes. Well, it turns out that it actually wasn't. And here was the answer. Parents would come into this fast food chain and they had been busy telling their kid no all day long. No, you can't do this. No, we're not going to buy that. No, you can't this. And so as it turned out, the milkshake was a relatively inexpensive and harmless way to say yes to the child that they had been saying no to all day long. Now, here's the thing. Would you ever figure out that people in the morning buy milkshakes as a form of breakfast?
No.
And milkshakes in the afternoon to appease their sense of guilt over the fact that they've said no to their children, would you ever arrive at those answers by asking, what could we do to improve the milkshake? Probably not, because it doesn't help the people think through the process.
It's so funny because I remember when the McDonald's increased this diameter of the straw, when I bought more milkshakes, I hated the milkshakes through the typical soda straw. And then when they increased the diameter of the straws,
all right, now, let's go back to the fast food restaurant for a moment. So with that information in hand, if you were the leader of a fast food restaurant chain, knowing that information, what are some of the changes you might make? You know that people buy milkshakes in the morning because they want something that's neat and clean and lasts long, that gives them a slice of entertainment while they drive to work. You know that people in the afternoon predominantly buy milkshakes to satisfy their guilt concerns. They want to give their kids something small that's a treat. Now, what does that information tell you that might help you to transform the food products that your restaurant offers?
At lunchtime, you flip the cups to the Disney cups. Because mom doesn't care what the kid thinks in school, it comes to the Disney cup, it's a treat for me. They all want whatever the, you know. Well, they did that essentially with the toys in the meals, Happy Meals.
Mm-hmm.
Who buys a Happy Meal in the morning? Nobody can tell them. I don't have to make their kids.
Well, I don't even know that there are Happy Meal breakfast meals, but that's a good question. I wonder if there are.
But, you know, they throw the toy in there and you know what I mean? But for the people in the morning, coffee flavored milkshake, something, you know.
Oh, okay. You would start to
toward adults, toward kids, flavors and you know.
That's it. Now, you're not in the business of selling food, okay? I guess you're not. Which means this is a theoretical question. But do you see how far away it takes you from conventional or conservative thinking? In order to have a fresh idea, you've got to ask the right questions to be able to see the thing for what it truly is. And very smart people asked the wrong questions and didn't arrive at the right answers. So in the course of doing this work, this company arrived at this statement, which I think is really helpful for all of us. What did you hire? What job did you hire this thing to do? Now that's a critical question. They asked that of the people who bought the milkshake. What did you hire this milkshake to do? What was your personal desire that you wanted that caused you to purchase this milkshake? That's a very different question than how could we improve the milkshake? So, what did you hire this thing to do gets at the root of personal buying biases and decisions. It's a more enlightened way of looking at it. All right, so we've looked at observation, evaluation. The next thing, to come up with new ideas. We call it the ideation process because it's got to rhyme with observation and evaluation. All right, that's just what I put there. Okay, so what is wanted, and what if? So what if is the pathway that we take to get from what is to what is wanted? So you've spent now a substantial amount of time understanding by observing and evaluating, which is what is. Now, we'll come back to the fast food chain. What is the end result that they want? The what could be? Well, if you're in the business of selling food, what's your bottom line? Sell more food, right? Isn't that really what you want to do? Sell more food, sell more profitably. So that gives you a way. This is what is. What if is everything in the middle. What if is where you begin to ask questions that could take you from here to here. What if we did this? What if we didn't do that? What if we destroyed this? So Pat works in an automotive shop. I assume that the owners of that shop are always looking for ways to improve sales. So if they began to ask questions about, well, who are our current customers? Why do they come to us? Why do they come to us instead of somebody else? Why do they come at the times that they do? That's what is. So a careful understanding of what is and a careful understanding of what you want more of. So what about a parent? This is the behavior you're getting from your parent, from your kids as a parent. And you understand it. You understand why you believe you're getting it. This is the behavior you want from your kids, which is different. Now, conservative thinking will say, well, if the child's behaving this way and you want them to behave that way, what we always do is this, whatever it is, in the middle. But what if thinking will cause you to ask, well, could we do it a different way that's still in keeping with our values and will get us what we want? You're desirous of helping some people who are struggling in their life to experience life at a richer level. I'm trying to make it as broad as possible so nothing falls outside that basket. So you know what you'd want for them, and you know what is. There are many ways in the middle, the what ifs, that could get you to a better this. All right. The next thing is communication. My word, if we had a dollar for all the ways in which people have failed to communicate. Now, I'm going to get political for a moment, okay? Now, I'll make no secret of the fact that I was not a Donald Trump fan whatsoever. But do you know? There's some principles that Mr. Trump has that, if they were properly communicated, might have been more appealing. If they had been communicated in more sane and sensible ways, they might have been more compelling. And if he had been able to inspire audiences with a vision of what his policies could bring about, there might have been less upheaval in the streets. There's no guarantee of that. But I believe that as much as anything else, what was lacking in Mr. Trump's overall campaign was a clear communication of what our country will look like 20 years hence if we begin to do these things, and how the people that feel that they're going to be marginalized will actually be helped. Never underestimate the value of communication. We're going to look at this again when we come to internal versus external leadership.
Get it across the multitude. What they were doing.
if you get past, here's the frustrating part. You can't take any one of these things out of the leadership equation. So you can have good, solid observation. You can evaluate it carefully and meticulously. You can come up with a plan for what you might do, but if you don't communicate it well, you don't get the buy-in that you just talked about. If you're a great communicator, but you don't have good ideas, what are you going to communicate? You're going to communicate weak ideas. If you haven't done the careful work of observing and evaluating, you don't know what idea, and you'll knee-jerk response and go off and create a multitude of new ideas. You literally cannot remove any one of these things from the leadership equation and have an effective leader.
The people that you're trying to reach need to see the person trying to lead as a utilitarianism mindset. You know, the most amount of good for the most amount of people. So if they're not seeing that, you know, that connection is negative. So in essence, target marketing. Who are you trying to reach? What are you trying to reach them with?
So let's say you have kids at home and you're simply trying to be a more effective father. Which of these are you weak in? Okay, so we'll get into now action. Right? Because ultimately, without taking some decisive action, nothing happens. This is the final thing that was there, not the final, but this is one of the final things that we said every leader needs to do. You need to take some action. Now, do you remember last week we introduced a couple of different types of leaders? There were actually four types of leadership that I suggested. The first was thought leadership. So Kennedy was a great thought leader. He was a great thought leader and a great communicator, but frankly, let's be honest, he knew nothing about putting men on the moon. Right? He couldn't have put a man on the moon to save his life. And then the next kind of leaders that we said are organizational leaders. They know how to bring people together in pursuit of a mission. It's not even necessarily their mission. They're just tasked with accomplishing it. So when Kennedy makes an inspirational speech, who actually are the action teams that make it happen? NASA engineers, NASA scientists, the people who are going to make this happen, the people in Houston, the people in Cape, was it Canaveral then? It must have been Canaveral because it became Cape Kennedy later. Okay, it's those people that make it happen. So there were system leaders that created an organizational process. All right, so, but all of these are necessary. The question is, which kind are you? Because I don't believe that you can necessarily be all of them. Are you a thought leader? Are you championing new ideas and putting them out before the people? Are you an organizational leader? You simply bring people together and you're the guy that knows how to get things done, even if it's not your idea. The next kind of leadership we said was moral leadership. You take a stand for something, you live in a particular way, you demonstrate through example what it looks like to live the thing that you want to see happen all around you. Incidentally, kids are pretty quick to pick this up, right? If you're a weak moral leader in your home, your kids will notice that. Right? You can be a skilled communicator. You can communicate effectively what your kids should do and why it would be in their best interest, but I challenge you to do that well without being an effective moral leader in your home. It's just not going to happen in the long term. And the final kind of leadership we said was systems development leadership. You, at a prototypical level, begin to develop the things that you want to see built out culture-wide. So we're going to look at Jesus for a couple of minutes here. Actually, I'm going to just encourage you to look at these things for yourself. So leadership as thought leadership, Jesus introduces, we'll call it the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Plain. They're revolutionary and transformative thoughts given to a religious culture about what their real mission is and how they would live it out. Do you remember some of the radical ideas that he suggests? That if you hate your brother, it's the same as killing him in the mind of God? What would you do after you heard that presentation? What would you go home thinking after you heard that presentation? If you looked at a woman, and in your head there were things going on that you would have wanted to do physically, but you knew was wrong, it was the same as having actually acted out on that. What's going through your mind after you hear that and you come home? The concept of loving your enemy, not just tolerating your enemy, but actually doing good on behalf of your enemy. These thoughts were not new. They had been expressed in the Old Testament, but Jesus made them relevant and cutting edge for that time and place. They were thoughts that needed to be introduced. So Jesus was a good thought leader. Now, what about organizational leadership? Let's actually turn over and look at this. Let's turn to Mark 6, 1 through 13. All right, Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things, they asked. What's this wisdom that has been given him, that he even does miracles? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son, the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? Now, it's interesting the way these names are enumerated. Isn't this the brother of these guys? And if you were reading that and you knew these people, you'd be thinking to yourself, okay, he's related to... I know what a screw-up this one is. I know how that one isn't quite... He's related to all these guys. He comes from the same household. How can he be this other thing when his family is like that? And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, only in his hometown, among his relatives, in his own house, is a prophet without honor. And so he could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. And he was amazed at their lack of faith. Now, what's his response to that? Okay, so you know who you are and you're attempting to do good for people and the people reject you. Now, what would your natural response be? Let's just be honest.
Well, you can become discouraged, downcast. Yeah.
And you said...
Defensive.
Defensive, or even take offense at.
Yes.
So the very people that you are trying to help are attacking you. Now, what does Jesus as a good leader do? He takes a different approach. Then Jesus went around teaching from village to village. Okay, so it starts out with he's going to heal. He's going to do these things while he teaches. He's going to heal people. But he says, what's the missing component? Why can't he heal many people? Okay, so the people don't believe. They're not ready to receive something from him. So his first step is to do what? To teach the people. So let's just talk about what God is in the business of doing. Let's just talk about what could be done. Let's help you to see yourself for who you are. Let's help you to see me for who I am. That's the teaching component. Calling the 12 to him, he sent them out two by two and gave them authority over evil spirits. These were his instructions. Take nothing for the journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in your belts. Wear sandals, but not an extra tunic. Whenever you enter a house, stay there until you leave that town. And if any place will not welcome you or listen to you, shake the dust off your feet when you leave as a testimony against them. And they went out and preached that people should repent. And they drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. In light of what we just read, isn't it interesting that Jesus can do very few miracles, and yet it almost implies here, actually it does imply here, that his followers seem to be able to do miracles. Now why?
Well, put that in parentheses, just before where nothing much took place, they said all these things about him. Recognized his wisdom, his authority, his power. Put that in parentheses, but they don't think how much happens, and then he delegates that. And he said it happened.
The people were less likely to resist the followers, because what were the followers? They were just regular people. And the followers went out actually to different... And he sets up a whole model for it. This is how you go do this.
Were the disciples... They claimed to be the Son of God, Jesus.
Right. But he sets them up with a pattern for how they can go do this. Now, they don't yet understand why, but why is he setting them up with this pattern? Well, if his message is going to gain traction, if his message is going to actually do what he intends it to do, which is travel the globe, how's it going to get done?
By his followers.
The majority of the work is going to get done by the followers, and so his mission is to build a system that will allow the followers to take the message. This is one of the other failing. Go ahead.
He said that greater works than these show you do. That's what he meant. And he stole from that.
One of the things where a lot of leaders suffer is they're not willing to invest enough time in building the systems to let the people that they lead do the work that they want done. So maybe now's a good point in time to... It would be... I might even be the backside of your front page. I believe it is. A broad base of influence requires a broad base of influencers. Is that on the backside of your front page? Okay. Here's the principle. When you lead one or two people, and your mission is to affect some sort of change in the outside world, you're focusing most of your efforts on what's in the outside world. Okay, so when you want to help a few people who need a better opportunity, you're going to do most of the work. It's your mission, you've owned it, you're asking the what-if questions, you're trying to get from here to there. But now, what if one of the things that you observe is that there's more than just one or two people that need to get there, that are here now and need to get there. There's literally thousands of them. And so you recruit a few people to help you. Here's the idea. The larger your internal organization grows, the more time you need to spend leading internally. And it is your people, as it were, not that you own them, but it is the people in your organization that are actually going to do the work of getting from here to there. Your job then becomes to care for the people so that the people can do the work of caring for the mission. And when a leader continues to be the hands-on guy getting from here to there and doesn't invest in the people that are getting from there here to there, the leader will continue to lead a smaller organization because he's forced to do most of the work himself. The larger your organization grows, the more time you need to spend informing, inspiring, motivating, rebuking, correcting the internal organization. It's why even in a church, you will see in almost every great church that people spend as much as a month or more of the year just reminding the people, this is what we're about, this is what we do. And what every leader knows, who has been a leader for any length of time, is you start to have the feeling, haven't I said this before? Like 20 or 30 or 40 times already? Don't they get it? Well, there's new people coming in the door every day. There's people leaving every day. There's new people coming in every day. And let's be honest, we leak. We forget. Do you remember something that you were excited about 2 years ago, and now that you think about it, you haven't done much about it in the last month? Two years ago, you were all about that. You were all over that. You were going to change the world in that area. And now, here it is 2 years later, and it's like on the back burner, if it's even there. You might have completely removed it from the stove. Why? What's changed? We need reminders. We need perpetual reminders about what we're to be doing and how and why. And as things change, I need to continue to invest there. So the mark of a growing organization is that the leaders are investing in the people so that the people can do the mission. Now, if you're leading a family, you don't have an external mission. If you're leading a family, you have nothing but an internal mission. But if you're leading an organization, and the organization is, let's say, tasked with selling food, like more milkshakes, then you need to be all about the process of developing the people within your organization that are actually going to lead that change. All right. Questions or comments before we move on?
Not at this time, sir. Not at this time.
But then he said, sir, all snarky-like, so... All right. We're actually going to come back to the idea that you talked about earlier, where you suggested that, was it Woodrow Wilson that you referenced? Okay. All right. We're going to come back to that now. You thought you said something that had no bearing on anything, but actually it did.
bad leader that died last night?
Fidel Castro. But interestingly, if you watched any of the news feeds or about that, so people in Miami, they're celebrating. So I'm told. I don't know. I wasn't in Miami last night. Meanwhile, people in Havana, it says that the city is remarkably quiet. Unusually quiet. Because the people there somehow, in spite of, don't ask me why, but they revere this man and they feel a sense of loss. So it's odd. Two different perspectives from two different groups of people. Same man, same leadership, same death, two completely different responses.
If you are, if you've grown accustomed to a time like Hitler or Fidel Castro, if you've grown accustomed to their way of life, their way of thinking, their operation, organization, you will, you know, through time, that becomes your way of life. You're used to it.
That's all you know.
So you embrace it. And after you embrace it, whether it's good or bad, you'll feel a sense of loss because it's something that you've taken after it's gone. So even if it's a terrible idea, people that are kidnapped, you know, over the course of time, you know, even months, they can create a connection.
Yep.
I
can remember a time, this is funny actually, because Fidel Castro was an American hero at the time. When I was about 11 or 12, people were wearing Castro hats, and then he became a bad guy after the Bay of Pigs. It was all because leaders directed us one way or the other. He was good, and then he was bad.
They thought he overthrew an evil regime. Yeah, he was a good guy, coming. Yeah, he had a choice to make. Either a Major League Baseball player or a dictator.
What? I did not know that.
He was in the minor leagues in America.
Yeah. Fidel.
Fidel, he was a baseball player.
Yeah, right after the Dodgers.
Yeah. That was Kennedy.
Bigger than the Dodgers.
Yeah. Dictator baseball player.
Okay. So was he just not good enough at baseball?
No, they think he could have been good enough.
Oh.
Yeah, there's great baseball players.
Yeah. All right, before we go too far afield with this illustration, it's actually good. All right. Does the name Frederick Taylor mean anything to anybody? I suspect not. All right, so we'll talk about the life of Frederick Taylor and how the life of Frederick Taylor actually has profound influence on a full century's worth of thought leadership when it comes to management and leadership. So Taylor grew up the son of a lawyer. It was expected he was going to become a lawyer. His father, I believe, worked at Princeton University. In addition to teaching law, he practiced law. And it was expected that young Frederick was going to follow in dad's footsteps. Somewhere during his teens, his eyesight developed troubles. He couldn't read as well as he had hoped to be able to read. And so his parents and he agreed that it might be a good idea for him to have a fallback plan. So they allowed him to go to work in a factory. Actually, it was a machining plant. Now, this is back in the days when it was before what you would call modern factories. So in the old days, before the time that we think of like Henry Ford and the assembly line, a factory process was more like you were a tradesman and you were a tradesman and you were a tradesman and you each worked at your own machine and you produced a finished product, but you produced it your way based on your set of techniques, you the same. No two people did things the same way. Their task was to try to achieve the same finished product. So if you know anything about early products, one of the great innovations that took place was the ability to have interchangeable parts. In other words, if a piece broke down in your Model T, the reason that it could be serviced and repaired is because that there was a part sitting on a shelf somewhere that was identical in all respects to the part that broke. And therefore, I could take any part off the shelf and put it in that Model T. It would fit, it would work, and it would perform. Come back to you. You machine things differently than John. They were sort of the same. They looked about the same. But you couldn't take your part and make it fit in something that John did, because everybody did things a little differently. All right, so Winslow noticed this. And he said to himself, well, or Taylor, I'm sorry, he said, there's got to be some way to do this better. But then he let that thought pass, and he went back to work. He evolved to the point that he was not just an apprentice, but after working as an apprentice for a number of years, he became a certified machinist. He became a leader of other machinists, and his supervisors noticed that and sent him off to run another plant. And his first mission was, I want you to, his boss said, I want you to improve the productivity. It doesn't seem we're making enough stuff. Well, he's great as a machinist, but he's not a great leader. And so what he does is goes in and tells you and you and you and you, you just need to work faster and get more done. And he's very heavy-handed. Now, what do you suppose tradesmen, artisans, skill, and a machinist at that time would have been a skilled position, a good paying position. How do you receive it when somebody tells you that you need to work faster?
You don't receive a blow.
No, not at all. And so what happened is he has a major revolt on his hands. If anything, instead of improving the process and getting more product out the door, it starts to blow up on him and he gets less product out the door. And so he does a complete reversal of this, and he starts to think, okay, instead of how can I force you to produce more, how could I help you to produce more? And so what he does is he starts to take the process of making a part, machining a part, and reduce it step by step. If they do this now, and that next, and that next, and that next, and it should take them 5 seconds to do this. And he literally, because he was an accomplished machinist, could go onto the plant floor, set himself up at a machine, time himself, and perfect methods. And so what he is famous for is systematizing and automating the process of producing a product literally down to the second. His influence is so great, but that by the time that we enter World War I, the military had adopted his processes and thinking, and it was pervasive. Our army should be able to move X number of feet per hour. They should be able to kill X number of people per minute. They should be using X number of bullets per hour in order to accomplish this. Now think about this. It accomplishes great things. Without him, the modern assembly line is literally impossible. But what does that do to the human component? Suppose you're a soldier and you're told this is your mission. You need to cover X number of feet per hour. You need to kill X number of people. You need to advance so far, use this many bullets, and no more. What does that do to your psyche?
You're desensitized. You just have those numbers before you. Whatever it takes, I'm going to do those numbers.
You become a machine.
Well, it forces you to... It forces you to disregard a lot of your safety protocols,
quality,
you know, your personal protocols, integrity, you know, this is not my mission.
Compromise.
All this is expendable.
I actually worked at a place like that, sheet metal shop, for a year. Now it closed up. They pushed piecework. I worked on every machine in that shop except for the spot welder. Which I'm glad I didn't just shoot out. But, it was the same thing that you were saying. You get out a certain amount of parts, then the president gets a bonus every 3 months. Well, after a year, I was let go because my quantity didn't meet their standards. I said, well, how about my quality? Did anyone think all of my quantity? I said, no. He gave me a layoff. But, and the thing is, the job nobody wanted always got pushed on me, the government jobs. Because everything had to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew if they got on those government jobs, their the quantity was going to go down. So more often than not, I got the job to do. But, after a year, and I worked every shift. You think up second shift, then first shift for a while, then third shift for a while, and back to second shift. But it folded up after, after I left about a year later. food shop.
Mm-hmm.
The manager, he was a bunch of baloney when he claimed he did it. It blew up his face eventually. His lack of, lack of knowledge.
Okay, and you're probably wondering what that had to do with what you introduced. But there was a key phrase that you said. There were people who knew, and there were people who did. And it was the job of those in leadership, exactly like you said, to do the thinking for the rest of the people who would do the acting. And so there was a detachment, if you will, of body from mind, and management represented the mind of the organization, and the worker on the floor represented the body of the organization, and if it weren't for the mind, the body wouldn't know what to do. Now, when these management concepts were first conceived, now you think about this in most organizational structure, do you still see evidence of that? Up until very recently, yes. As a matter of fact, the Japanese are the first ones to start to overturn this, where somebody on the assembly line could actually stop the line. Up until the Japanese reinvented what we kind of like perfected, that was unheard of. Nobody on the assembly line could stop the line. That was the job of management.
To be a management person in Japan, you have to start at the lowest job and do all those jobs.
So you knew. My dad's not here today. He stopped many of the lines and factories because he was quality control for Ford Motor Company in heater air conditioning. And he called on factories around the country
mm-hmm.
that build those parts, and they have to have a certain quality, and they weren't meeting that. He stopped many of factories' lines. I worked in one, and when I was out of high school, I've seen him show up and inspect and shut down lines. And people are happy. They don't understand what's going on. But this is not correct. It will not work.
So, there's good to this. There's good to a division, and this is what every leader needs to be sensitive to. You may have great ideas. You may actually have superior ideas to the people that you lead. I mean, we live in a democracy, a republic. But in this republic, everybody gets a voice. Everybody gets a vote. And do you think all people are equally informed when they go to the polls? Oh my word, no. Right? And so actually our system is set up to attempt to balance that. But what anyone who leads must understand is that while the people that you are leading may not have as solid an idea or as much research behind it, that doesn't mean that they're any less attached to their way of thinking. So here is where great humane leadership comes into place. What do you think is God's supreme endowment to people? We've talked about it here before. What is the greatest gift that God has given to people, do you believe? Free will. The ability, said a different way, the ability to choose. Whenever I as a leader override your ability to choose, what have I actually done? This is now we're moving into a spiritual element here. Whenever I override your ability to choose, and I'm not talking about you're a child, I'm talking about you're a responsible adult, what have I done? And? Within constraints, and you can cite exceptions to this rule, I have taken away the endowment that God has given to you. I have actually removed from you the ability for you to live as God intended you to live. There you go. I've actually stolen. So if God's greatest gift to us is the gift of being able to choose, and I take that choice away from you, then I've violated one of God's principles. So my mission as a leader is to attempt to inspire change, doing it within the confines of free will. Now think about this. This is why dictatorship is so appealing as a form of government. Right? If you've ever led a family of four, you know why dictatorship is such an appealing idea. I can't get my will with the people. I can't get something. How slow is it to take everybody's will into account? very time consuming. As a matter of fact, you probably are trying to help people get to a better end that aren't even sure that they want to get to that end as much as you want to get them to that end. Now, I could be wrong about that, but some people are really stuck in what is. They're not even sure they want to get to what could be.
Oh, yeah.
Would you disagree?
No. I found myself trying to help people so much, more than they wanted to help themselves. I had to back off. You're not helping yourself at all. That's where this vision casting and communication and repetition is so important that you're talking about. That's why what you just said in Japan, so that worker has an understanding of what we're trying to do, that problem.
And here's what I want to do. This is going to become your homework assignment, but I want to take us back to the book of Nehemiah. Now, Nehemiah is this classic textbook study of leadership, but I don't like starting with the book of Nehemiah, which is why we started with the book of Ezra last week, because I think there are probably more lessons in great leadership to be found in the book of Ezra than there are in the book of Nehemiah. Yeah.
Is that already in the next word? We need to write that down.
What?
Nehemiah.
It is not. So you're probably just write yourself a note that this week, how many of you actually read through the book of Ezra last week? And I gave you exemption from all the genealogies and all the other stuff. Okay, so we've got one person who actually did that. So you remember from the little diagrams that we drew last week, and we said that it might, from a human perspective, seem a little bit backwards. We said that the first mission of the people who returned under Cyrus was to build an altar. Now, around that, they were then going to build a temple. Now we pick up first chapter of Nehemiah. The word of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. All right, so there's two questions there. What are the questions? Yeah, I mean, is anybody following along? What are the questions?
In the book?
Yeah, in the book. What are the questions that he wants to know? Distilled down into two concise things. What's he asking about? What's the condition of the city? What's the condition of the people?
Yep.
Those are his two questions. Tell me about the city. What's going on with the environment? What's going on with the people? So, it's helpful to understand that he's give or take about 1,000 miles away at this point in time. He is months' journey by foot. And he asks this question. And what's the answer? And they said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. And then his response, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept for some days. I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, and you can read this prayer for yourself. It's important that you read the prayer. At the end of this, he says, I was the cupbearer to the king. Now, he has to introduce that because he has to explain how it is that he has some influence. Now, here's the amazing thing. Within the first several verses, the entire situation in Jerusalem is assessed. What's the situation? Remember, he asked the question about the city and about the people. So what's the answer that he gets? Well, come on, people. What's the answer he gets?
It's not good.
It's not good. Okay. So, the city itself, the outer wall of protection, is still crumbled, decayed. It's in the same state it was when the people first returned there. What's the morale of the people?
Not good.
It's beaten down. Now, remember, if you read through the book of Ezra, go ahead.
There were two sides. Not everybody was in despair.
That's true, but what is the outcome that's happened as a result of this? Well, this... See, everybody can see that there's a problem. This is critical. Anybody can see that there's a problem. Right? You're not a genius as a leader because you discover that there's a problem.
The need wants to know, is anybody doing anything about the problem? Is there progress? Are they trying to rectify the situation?
Now, the first reason why this book is an astounding example of leadership is this. There were already hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, literally thousands of people that had returned there. They already knew the condition. Now, I'm going to ask you an obvious question. Who is more likely to lead a movement to rebuild a city wall? The people who live in it or one guy 1,000 miles away?
Well, the people that are there.
See, it's not as if when Nehemiah asked the question, the guy said, oh my word, I hadn't thought about that. Well, let's see. Let me take stock here. Well, yeah, I think there's a part of that wall. I haven't been out to that wall in a while, but I think it's broken down. No, they were very specific. The gates are burned, the wall is torn down, the people are demoralized. Where should that change to build the wall have risen up from, naturally, organically, from there back in Jerusalem? This is why this is amazing. Have you ever noticed a problem and thought somebody else should do something about it? And yet Nehemiah's first response is, apparently nobody else is doing something about it. Okay, chapter 2. In the month of Nisan. All right, now, the Jews have two calendars. They have a civil calendar that they govern by. They have a sacred calendar that determines their religious festivals. So what we're going to do is we're going to assume that this is the civil calendar that they're operating from. That makes this first statement taking place in what we'll say the third month of the year. And this second statement in the month of Nisan, which is at the beginning of chapter 2, in about the seventh month. So third month through the seventh month. In other words, for 4 months, he sits on this idea. For 4 months, he sits with this awareness. For 4 months, he prays. For 4 months, he thinks. For 4 months, he looks for the right opportunity to make the next move.
This is all in the same 4 months? Or he took 4 months for each item?
No, this is all in the same 4 months. He's thinking about what to do. He's praying to God. We're going to assume that at multiple times throughout this 4 months, he's fasting and he's praying and he's asking.
Shot about him last week, I missed last week.
No, we did not. We did not start.
He has a high position in present day Iran, and he's a cupbearer to the king. And he started off as taken from captivity from Jerusalem. So now he's risen up, lived his life as a captive, but with an honorary position because of his intelligence and abilities. Right. So here he is, like he did, gets this information. He's more like a Joseph, as Joseph was in Egypt, always just report he's in captivity in Persia.
Okay, so chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought to him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you were not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart.
And that is dangerous right there. For him to portray any of that before the king, he's going to be killed for that.
All right, now, just does everybody know what a cupbearer is?
Yeah, he drank the wine. He didn't kill him, so it's okay.
Right. That's why the cupbearer sampled the food, tasted the wine. Everything that the king would eat, the cupbearer took first because, yeah, if something bad happened to you, then at least it didn't happen to the king. Sucked to be you that day, but at least the king lived. Now, so long as the king didn't have enemies that got inside the food kitchen, it was a good job to be the cupbearer. Let's just stop right there. Who are you and what do you have that makes you think that you could not be and do something else? Did cupbearing need to continue to be done? Of course it did. The king was not about to sample the food himself, so the job of cupbearer would need to continue on. But does the job of cupbearer seem like one that qualifies you? In other words, you're a food taster. You might actually offer some counsel to the king. You might actually hear some private conversations, because there might be conversations that occurred while the food was being eaten. There's a lot of...
Obviously, he trusts you greatly.
Yeah.
You're in the inner spectrum there.
But does that seem like the kind of job that qualifies you to go travel 1,000 miles and undertake another civil works project? Remember what we said. To the Jews returning, this was a religious work. To the Persians sending, it was a civil works project. They did not see this as anything but a way to appease the god of that country, because by appeasing the god of that country, it would do well for them. Right? It was an astute leadership move on the part of Cyrus and his successors to send these people back. But to the Jews who were returning, this was a work of religious fervor. All right, so in the month, Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when the wine was brought to him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." And I was very much afraid. But I said to the king, "May the king live forever." Always a good thing to say first. "Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" And the king said to me, "What is it that you want?" How does the king draw that connection? That's interesting.
That's pretty amazing.
Right? So he's not just saying, "I'm sad about this." The king infers from all that, you want to do something about this, don't you? And then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried, so that I can rebuild it." And then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take you, and when will you be back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. So what's happening for 4 months? For 4 months, he's preparing for this day, even though he doesn't know when this day is going to come. Have you ever heard the phrase, "Pray as if it all depends on God, act as if it all depends on you"? Nehemiah kind of epitomizes that. There's a balance that you see throughout all of Scripture, where in one sense, it seems to imply that nothing happens without God, and yet clearly, in the mirror sense of it, it seems as if nothing happens unless people act. And so we tend to get paralyzed by being polarized. We tend to think it mostly depends on God, and so we sit and wait for God. Or we tend to think it mostly depends on us, and therefore we go ahead and act, and maybe we take God along for the ride. But it's a balance. So, what are you not giving to this mission that you think? What are you not giving to this thing that you see that needs to be done? What are you not giving? And the reverse of it is, what are you not entreating God for in this? Remember this phrase, one more time: pray as if it all depends on God, act as if it all depends on you.
He had a plan, and he had to speak up. He prayed all that through, but he had a plan, and he had to speak up.
We should say one other thing about cupbearers. Cupbearers did not serve the king every day. There was a rotation. You never knew when you were going to be the cupbearer. You never knew the day. If there was 10 cupbearers in the palace, you never knew which day was going to be your day to test the food. Why? Because then you could not be involved in some conspiracy.
Sometimes they died.
Well, okay. So sometimes they needed to be replaced, is what John was saying. Oh, there you wonder what happened to Joe. Oh, Joe's no longer with us. All right, so if you read on, you're going to read that he has a pretty specific plan. This is important. For 4 months he'd been evaluating. If this moment comes, I know exactly what I need to ask for. We'll jump down to verse 11. I went to Jerusalem. Okay, now the distance between the couple of verses above it and there is months of time and a journey of give or take 1,000 miles. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding. Okay, so why go out by night and why take only a few men? You're going to expect a wall that you have never seen. You're going to inspect a wall that you have never seen in an area that you're not really familiar with. Why not go in the daylight and take a number of people with you?
Everybody doesn't need to know yet. It's not time. There's more people. I mean, I'm thinking from a military standpoint, if there's more people, you're going to be more easily detected. You know, and I'm guessing that there was probably not everybody was on board with this idea.
Right.
Remember what we already said? Who were the most likely people to rebuild the wall? Why does a guy have to be imported from 1,000 miles away to rebuild the wall? So what do you think was going to be the mindset of most of the people that he would have recruited to help him tour the wall?
We'll build our own wall.
Or we can't do this. We've tried to do this. Remember, these people have been under opposition. Yeah, this is impossible. We've tried to do this. This can't work. Look, it took us forever just to get the temple built up again.
And they had their reasons. They can list them all.
So if you're going to do something great, you may need to distance yourself from the people who have tried to do something before and failed because their attitude is liable to infect you. Okay, so it says, and after touring this, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. And then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins. Its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be a disgrace." I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. Okay, so we said that one of the indispensable qualities of great leadership is communication. That I have to be able to put the idea out before people in a way that inspires them. There's three things to Nehemiah's, we'll call it a speech. Let's read this again. "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins. Its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be a disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me." What are the three appeals he makes to the people?
He has his God's support. So he's appealing to the mindset. He's also...
Okay, point number one. God is with us. Now, keep in mind, to the people that were already living there, it might not have looked that way. So Nehemiah brings a fresh story of the fact that God has validated my intent to do something by making this whole trip possible. The probability of my being here from 1,000 miles away, released from my duties, not only released from my duties, but given letters that allow me to buy materials, that give me safe passage, all the stuff that we didn't read. He's given letters that allow him to buy materials. He's given them all this. God is with us, and that did not seem possible to me. What's next? You were going to say another one.
Okay, he was appealing to their, their physical presentation, their standpoint. To improve the view of their city, like how people look at them in their city. The king's word. The king gave his word.
Okay. So we've got two things going on, and we're going to call this, I'm going to tie this to, we will no longer be a disgrace. National honor.
That's what I was trying to do. Good thing.
The next one, which you said, essentially support of the empire. In other words, even though there's a small faction right here in our region that is opposing us, the leader of the whole empire, he's behind us. There's one final one. It's the first one he appeals to. So long as the walls remain down and damaged, you're in danger. You're not secure. So the fourth one is security. So we'll look at it one more time. God is with us. Your honor can be restored. Do you feel dignified and honored identifying as a Jewish person in the city of your birth or the city of your origin, so to speak? And this is what it looks like. We have the support not only of God, we have the support of the empire, but our very security is at stake. No. What makes this remarkable is that there's nothing here that Nehemiah appeals to that was not known by everyone that was there. You can tell that by the speed with which they respond. They knew every one of these things was true already. If you ever doubt that great leadership is essential, consider this. They had everything there the day before Nehemiah showed up to redo this wall that they had the day after he showed up. The only thing that was lacking was a unifying person to get them all behind this and make them believe again what was possible that they had only the day before thought was impossible. Just let that settle in. This is the value of one person. Nehemiah does very little of the work. He's one man. Think about how long it would take one man to build a wall. Right? It's not up to him to do the work. It is up to him to inspire the people to do it. All right. I think I've... Yep, sure enough. I've run out of time again. Read the story. We'll come back next week and we'll talk about it. So if you didn't get time to do your homework from last week, which was to read Ezra, now you've got 2 weeks worth of work to do. So...
Oh, this is great.